Okay, welcome everybody back to the matters titled VHI Halacha Seminar Series. Tonight's topic is a little bit out of the box, not our typical real estate or legal topic. Food and kashrus in the workplace. I'll just tell you an interesting story how this topic came about. This is a story that happened in Madison Title just a few weeks ago. We have, like many other offices, we have a number of Keurig machines with the K-cups, and we've had them for a number of years, and we have all different flavors for all the employees to use anytime, clients that come in. Well, we have machines that they go into after use. The K-cups go into a bin. So a few weeks ago, one of the people was full, cleaning out the bin, and lo and behold, in the bin was a Campbell soup flavor, chicken broth flavored K-cup. We didn't either. Apparently, they started recently, but I did some research, and apparently Progresso Soups has been making them for a couple of years already. Not chicken broth, but some other trade flavor. So that triggered, I won't go into the details. What?
No,
they didn't go through the strainer, didn't make it through. So that trigger, I'm not going to go into exactly the halakhic implications that would happen to us. Every situation has its own variables. But that, triggered the thought process of getting this. There are many other shaylas, as you'll hear, that come up in the workplace. And that's how we came about to today. So I hope everybody know eight before they got into the room, because I don't know what he's going to be speaking about. And no guarantees on being able to eat afterwards. Anyway, so it's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Yaakov Shulman, who is very the right person to speak on this topic. If you look at his bio, he has Rav Paskins, who's been involved in the kashrus industry, involved in business. So he covers all bases in terms of this topic. And it's a pleasure, it's close to have Rabbi Yaakov to speak and give us words on the topic.
Thank you, and welcome everyone. Just the story with the K-cups sort of points out, well, we all know that you can't always trust the K. comes to kashrus. I don't know if the Star K has yet started doing K-cup, Hechsherim. But this is an example of things that come up in the workplace. It doesn't have to only be here, but generally it's more complicated when you have people that are at different levels of kashrus or none at all. The topic tonight, we could really ask, is you just alluded to, what's it doing in the Business Halacha Institute? Because the word business halacha implies that these are halachas regarding business. Hilchos Ribbis, Nekach HaMemkar, Aynah, all the various things, Tzchiras Poelim, the things you need to know when you're running a business. What about food? Well, I think there's really another take, which is Business Halacha Institute is going to teach us that halacha applies to all of life, including when you're at your business. That the Yiddishkeit is a holistic enterprise. It's not something that we do in the Beis Medrash or at home or in our shul. And then we come to work and suddenly we're transformed, we're in a different climate, different environment, and Tiras Hashem is sort of off to the side, and we do our work, and we come back home, and all of a sudden we're enveloped again in our daf yomi and our learning with our kids and the kashrus of our kitchen and so on. I think the idea tonight, we'll see, is that we're enveloped in Yiddishkeit 24 hours a day, and your commitment to Avodas Hashem in the office is no different than that when you're in the middle of davening with Talis and Tefillin. It's the same Yid, same Ribbono Shel Olam. And one of the ways we express that is through eating. We know that the Shulchan is Doim Olam Mizbeach, and there is an essential concept that everything we ingest becomes a part of us. It says even an Isha Meinekes, Ramav says in Yoredeya, a nursing woman, although she may eat if necessary, if there's a pikuach nefesh, she's allowed to eat tarfus. However, we say that if she's nursing, she should refrain, if at all possible, and try to be cured in a way that doesn't involve tarfus. Why? Because the vlad, through her milk, is going to ingest something that's treif. Pretty amazing. It's been recycled into her milk, which is kosher. At the same time, it's metamtem zaleif. There's an inyan about the food itself and the way we eat that's radically different than the way the world perceives eating. So, if you look at your outline, I thought I'd begin with a little review of kashrus in general in the United States. A little history of it, where we came from, where we're holding. Around the turn of the previous century, around the year 1900s or thereabouts, New York City had the one and only Rav HaKollel. He was the chief rabbi of New York City, which he was invited to come from Vilna, Rav Yankov Yosef, who was a great magid, machaber of Sfarim, and he was chosen from the Rabbanim in Europe to come and lead the what was called the Ichud HaKehilas, the united congregations of essentially the Lower East Side at the time, that was Yiddishkeit. And one of the things he discovered when he came here was that kashrus was a total chaos. Every local butcher picked whoever he wanted to paskin for him. It went from rov to rov. There was graft. It was estimated that among the shechita, maybe 30-40% were not even geshachted properly. Tarfus, it was rampant. It was amazing what was going on. And Ishkal Yashav Einav Yasa, he tried to put a uniform standard on it, and the way they were going to fund it, they were going to have an organization that charged 1 cent per chicken. That was the tax. To put on a plumba with the signature and the seal of the chief rabbinate, and it would have certain standards that needed to be met. He was met with such a firestorm, and it was said that he was taking this penny, taxing the Jews, and living off the proceeds, that the whole thing fizzled, his health failed, he passed away a few years later. Didn't work. In Chicago, the Ridvaz, Rabbi Yankel David, who had been the Slutsky Rav, one of the great Gaonim, was there, and he also, there's a story my Shver tells me, he grew up in Milwaukee, in the Midwest, they have this tradition, that the head of the Butchers Union came in to see the Ridvaz, and he says, you know, you're threatening our livelihood. You make all these requirements. You have to do things according to your halacha. And if you don't stop it, he pulled out a pistol. He says, I'm going to shoot you right now. The Ridvaz took open a shirt, tore it open. He says, sheesh, shoot me. Of course, the guy got really afraid. He put it away. He ran out. But this is what was going on there. Right? This was kashrus in America. He, of course, left Chicago, went to Eretz Yisrael, where he wrote the Ridvaz on the Yerushalmi. So kashrus began as a local enterprise, often under a kind of cabal of shoichtim, people who purveyed. The Rabbanim didn't have very much to say about it. It then, slowly but surely, largely through the efforts of the Orthodox Union, which began 50, 60 years ago with a heksher, I think the first heksher they gave in the 1950s was on Sunrise Crackers, 1940s. The name is Sunshine Crackers, how it began. And then slowly but surely it picked up steam. The marketing of kashrus began, it can be traced to 1972, it was an ad that ran on TV, which I remember as a kid. It was by Hebrew National. And it shows Uncle Sam eating a hot dog, a Hebrew National hot dog, you know, with a beard and a USA hat, red, white, and blue. And in the back, on the screen, it says, we answer to a higher authority. Okay. That was the beginning of the marketing, to show that it wasn't some dusty old thing that, you know, elderly Jews in the Bronx did. It was for everyone. And it was cleaner, it was better, it was washed more carefully. And that began to go in the American consciousness. This was 1972. In 2010, there was a book published called Kosher Nation, which sort of gives you a glimpse of the whole kosher industry. The numbers there are the entire food industry in America is $500 billion, of which kosher products, of them, more than $200 billion are kosher, certified with Asher, which is beyond ludicrous. Okay, how many Jews are there in America? 4.5, 5 million, something like that, out of 330. That's less than 2%. And only possibly 20% of Jews keep kosher. There are 10% Orthodox, and another 20% maybe among all the others that keep kosher. That's what? A million Jews, less. So a million Jews out of 330 million is like one third of what, you know, maybe $1 billion ought to be kosher. 200 billion or more. What happened? There was an incredible marketing effort, and the climate became favorable towards kashrus. In the 1990s, you may remember Entenmann's went kosher. It was a red letter day in American Jewish history. You could walk into your local, it was nationally marketed. It was not that easy to get national brands. It used to be only on the East Coast, maybe out in LA. That was about it. Entenmann's is everywhere. You can go, I remember I used to teach for Esha Torah. I taught the Discovery Seminar. We were down in Arkansas. Okay, we had a Shabbaton outside of Memphis. We're in Arkansas. And I took my son, he had accompanied me. We went into a supermarket. There's a chain there called Piggly Wiggly. You'll be mindful of the name. Okay? We're walking to the Piggly Wiggly, and we're staying there a couple of days. We need to eat something. We walked out in Arkansas with two shopping bags full of items with Hechsherim, national Hechsherim on them. They're everywhere. Entenmann's went kosher in the 90s. Godiva Chocolates, a very upscale, fancy name, which immediately attracted the attention of all the other purveyors and providers. They wanted to do it as well. Then Nabisco, which is the largest marketer of crackers and these kind of products. They're in every 7-Eleven in America, everything, everywhere you go. It's hard to miss Nabisco. So it became marketed and distributed everywhere, and now the attitude began to change. It used to be that non-religious Jews were very hostile towards kashrus. Famously, they would have treif get-togethers. Federation now often has kosher dinners, which is unheard of 40 years ago. The entire climate became more supportive because in general, in America, the attitudes began changing about foods. Ethnic foods are accepted. There's an idea of expression. And then we all know that there are many groups of people that have diet restrictions. You have the vegetarians, so they love kosher. When it says parva, they know there's no meat products, no animal products. So that's a huge amount of marketing to people who never, you know, they don't know Jews. They only know that kosher means there's no parva, there's no animal products. Or if it's parva, there's no dairy. Because dairy, there's many lactose intolerant people. So lactose intolerant will go after kosher food. The gluten intolerant, which is another segment of the population that purchases food, around Pesach, they stock up. Some stores report that their Pesach products disappear within a week or two before Pesach. Before, the kosher keeping housewife has a chance to buy all the products. They're gone. They have to reorder for the inventory. Why? All the non-Jews, or everyone, Jews or non-Jews, that eat gluten-free, they come there. Of course, there's no matzah milk, right? A lot of the products are non-gebrux. There's no matzah milk. You can get everything you need for the rest of the year. So there's a lot of groups that buy because they trust that the supervision is there. One fine day, a Yid came to our shul. He'd been with us for a few months till he was transferred. He was in the military. He came in under a program that fast-tracked medical personnel. He was an optometrist. He told me when the war was still on in Iraq, he used to examine the pilots' eyes and so on. That was his job. So when he was stationed there, when he was deployed, as they say, in Iraq, he says, kosher food? They didn't know what to do for you if you were kosher. It was coming from all sides. You didn't even have to speak to the chaplain. You mentioned it up the chain of the command. You had kashrus, you had packages, you had microwavable dinners, MREs, meals ready to everything. All kosher, glad kosher, certified, hechsherim, symbols, everything. He told me, directive number one in the U.S. military, no alcohol. That's number one. First directive in the whole book, military rules. There's one exception, and that is Kiddush Friday night for Jewish soldiers. So he would get a case of Kenem wine every Friday delivered to him under strict protocol and security. And of course he had the biggest service Friday night. Every Jew or whoever thought they were Jewish came, crowded into the service, and then of course you all had Kiddush. So the military is very kosher friendly. The whole society that we live in has become kosher friendly, and this is a story of kosher marketing, Jewish ingenuity, like everything else. You know, we're small people. Atem ha-ma'at mikol ha-amim, and somehow our impact is vast. Almost half of the food industry in America is kosher certified. It's gone from local certification to communal organizational. And that, of course, means the big four. And who are they?
Star K, and the OK, Circle K.
Okay, those are the big four. And I must tell you, I remember when my father was a rabbinic consultant for Rabbi Center, Rabbi Harvey Center, the father of the... So he asked me once to be a mashgiach. I learned a little bit about what goes on in the factories. The intermediate products that go into your foods, and there are, without exaggeration, dozens and sometimes hundreds of one product. In one cookie, you can have flavoring, you can have emulsifiers, you can have different kinds of flour. They're not all under one hechsher. If the Star K is giving a hechsher on a cookie, don't think that from the wheat, from the time it left the farm, and the butter and the flavor, everything else, till it hits your mouth, is all Star K. It couldn't be. They couldn't possibly control that entire chain of production. So they all inter-exchange among each other. So if you eat OU, you're also eating Chav K, Star K, and OK. The four of them cooperate, they exchange information, research bulletins. You know, I'm just giving you a sense of what goes on in the industry. There are those who don't eat any of this stuff. I mean, the ones that go into Chassidus Hashem, which is a different story. They have their own chain of commands, their own interchange, their own, you know, pros and cons as well.
Depends
on whom. Okay, without getting into, you know, good, not good. Okay, there are two things, but they are much, much smaller than the big four. The big four, among the four of them, have 80% of the products. And practically all the intermediate products, because the non-big four, the small ones, will do one specific thing. There'll be a run of grape juice or of mandarin oranges from, you know, Lieber's or whatever, one of this, Geffen, this type of thing. But the day-to-day products and the industrial ones, the big ones, General Mills, Kellogg's, all these are all from the large organizations. So the availability is there, the distribution is national. I'll tell you my own experience. You know, I used to go literally all over teaching Peshat Torah. The only thing you couldn't find years back was bread. And I'm going to tell you why. Bread, the Gemara says in Pesachim, you're not allowed to bake it with schmaltz. Tanur shetoshei ba'alyo, if you put schmaltz on the floor of the oven, you're not allowed to bake bread, and if you did, it's what we would call treif. You're not allowed to eat it even with fleishiks. Why? For the simple reason, you're going to forget. You're going to eat it with milk. You're going to put butter on it. Alternatively, you're not allowed to put a milk into bread. Bread may not be cooked with milk, baked with milk, because you might eat fleishiks. So 95% of bread in America is made with milk. You go down the bread aisle in the supermarket, and you usually go to bakeries. Just for once, go to it, it smells, you can smell the fresh bread. You look at every package, milk, 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 milk. Even if you're not talking about Chol Yisrael, even someone who drinks Chol Stam, but it's, you can't put it in the bread. So therefore, bread is not available. Today, even that's available. I mean, there is Levy's real kosher Jewish rye, which has become a national product. Why? Because the packaging is much better. The shelf life is much greater. So you can get it everywhere. And then you have Arnold, which has is milk-free. There's a number of them. To summarize, kashrus in America is so widespread, it would be a difficult endeavor not to keep kosher, literally. To try to eat treif without a kashrus would be a difficult job because there's so much kosher products around. This is really the context in which kashrus enters the workplace. Because, again, 30, 40 years ago, what was kashrus? You came with a tuna fish sandwich. When I began, I worked at the New York Times for 20 years. Okay, I did a variety of things, including some corporate training, I did marketing strategy, a number of things. When I first began, every day, what did I eat? A tuna fish sandwich. Well, my wife made me tuna fish. That's what I ate for 20 years. There wasn't anything else. You know, there were one or two places in Manhattan, and then they started getting more and more. But you couldn't really get something other than what you brought from home. Now, everywhere you go, there's kosher food. You can get packages, you have these self-warming things, you have all kinds of stuff. And therefore, eating has become now not a personal event at the office, but a collegial event. So in today's world of teamwork and quality circles and all the rest of that, for what it's worth, you know, whatever you make of it, we are caught up in the fact that, well, why aren't you joining us? I mean, kosher food, it's everywhere. In the old days, oh, we understood, you know, Shulman can't eat with us. He's eating his tuna fish. He'll join us afterwards. But now, why can't you sit there and eat and enjoy and talk and schmooze about all the things they talk about?
It's not just eating. When I was a summer associate, we had a cooking activity.
Cooking, actually.
But my rabbi said that because it would be meat and milk, you can't even cook it.
Correct. Fortunately, right? So you could beg off. Okay. Okay. See,
it was pork.
Yeah, right. That's the thing.
You can't do meat and milk.
Right, right. A kosher animal and a kosher milk. Right, pork with all the only drabbanon. This is, we all know. Esav, when the Malach of Esav was wrestling with Yaakov Avinu, it says Vayeovek ish imai adalois hashachar. He fought. Interesting word the Torah uses. Vayeovek. So Rashi says famously to Pshatim. They fought, they hit it, fisticuffs, and grappling and wrestling. Or vayechavek, they hugged, because when you wrestle, you hug, there's certain forms of wrestling where there's a lot of body contact. And therefore, it says vayechavek, like vayechavek. So what does that mean? This I heard from Baruch Sachs, remember, you might know him from, he was in Magen Av all the years, and he may have retired since. Anyway, I had him as a Rebbe in Yankov Yosef years back. So he says, the pshat is, Esav comes after us one of two ways. Either he fights us, pogroms, the old style. Pogroms, persecution, inquisitions, the whole bit. Or he comes after, he wants to hug us. Come here, come join me. You need kosher food, here it is. Come with us, play with us, enjoy. So this second way of coming closer to the world of Esav is really what the rest of this talk is about. And this is food in the workplace. This is number two on your outline. It is considered and looked upon as a social lubricant. Because it really is. You have a meeting. What do they put out? Something to eat. You have a bigger meeting. Now it's ready lunch. You have a real big meeting. Oh, now you have to entertain your client at a better restaurant. The wine list. Everyone has to show how much French they know. The sommelier comes in, and this is a good wine. Yeah. We want to lubricate the process through food. And that becomes part of doing business. Actually, most of the meal is spent in talking about everything other than business. The kids and your alumni and your football team that you follow, all the rest of that. Finally, the end of the meal, by the way, about this project we're working on, about the stock offering, whatever industry you may be doing, the legal deal or the contract, that's taken care of in 5 minutes because you've already lubricated it through the medium of food. Chazal were well aware of this, and they said there's an entirely different approach that we have to food. It's not a frivolous exercise. It's not there to lubricate closeness and doing a deal. It's part of Avodas Hashem, right? Famously, Chazal says, "Shulchan shel Adam is kimizbeach." If I'll be in the Beis Hamikdash offering a karban, I'd have a certain mindset, feel close to Hashem. My mind would be pure. My actions do l'shem shemayim. The zevach needs six things. One of them is kavana l'shem zevach. When I eat, it's the same. It's kimizbeach today. So when I'm eating, I want to eat l'shem shemayim. This is a uniquely Jewish concept. Gemara famously says that a guy, non-Jew lahavdol, can bring a carbon. We can be mekabel karbanos min ha'akum. Carbon oil. Carbon oil means it's completely burnt. It's offered to God. It has nothing to do with us. No one is that. It's a purely religious gesture. Right? Take the animal, you burn it, no one is that. The fact that you can eat shlomim, that's only a yid. I'm eating most of the animal, only a small portion. The chalev goes in the mizbeach, and you give the chaz of a shoik to the kohen. But most of it, the greatest percentage, I'm eating, like I would eat supper. And I eat it for supper. Shnei yomim v'lai lechel. So, what does it mean? It means I take what would normally be gashmius, becomes a supremely divine and spiritual experience. That's reserved for Yiddishkeit, and that's eating, that's what Chazal gave us in their halachas of eating. So, for example, they gave us safeguards. We all know these. These are part of the Yud Ches Dover, the Gemara on Shabbos. There were 18 gzeiros on the day that they went up to Aliyah's Beis Nitzah B'lud, and they answered all up Sefer Yecheskel. While they were there, they took a minyan, and Beis Shammai was greater than Beis Hillel, and under those historic circumstances, they made 18 gezeiros, of which four are very important for this. There were goyim on Pas Shol Goyim, not allowed to eat bread baked by a goy. We'll see in a moment how that affects us. You're not allowed to eat cholov shalakum, milk, shlokos, which are cooked items of a guy, and yayin shalakum, also wine, which of course we know you need a hechsher and all these things. Let's take a look at just very briefly at these, and then we're going to get into some specifics in a moment. Okay, yayin shalakum. What is wine? Wine is any liquid as soon as it leaves the grape. Grape juice is wine. Grape juice is wine. We call it grape juice to distinguish it from fermented wine, which is that the bacteria act upon the sugars present in the juice. Bacteria is on the skin, they act on the sugars in the juice. They break it down into alcohol. When the alcohol level reaches 12%, what happens? It gets too strong, kills bacteria. So it's a self-limiting process, generally. Okay, you don't need to wait until it's wine, fermented and alcoholic, to be yayin shalakum. We prohibit it as soon as it leaves the grape, which means it needs to be under care. Now, we all know that this is only yayin she'enay mevushal, wine that's not cooked. Wine that is cooked, number one, is not as good wine. It's not considered as high quality as uncooked wine. If you go above $20 a bottle, you'll be hard-pressed to find yayin mevushal. Okay, below it, in the range that I guess many of us, at least myself, you know, except for Kiddush, I try to buy the yayin she'ena mevushal tzehider. Yayin that is cooked is pasul for the mizbeach, for that reason. You can't make nisach hayayin if it's cooked, because it's not as good wine. So the Chacham said, it's not such great wine, so then it's not that much of a social drink. You wouldn't put out cheap stuff on there, this cheap wine. You put out the good wine. The good wine, Chain of Mavushal, is aser. Okay, now in the old days, when there was a Vaidazar Mamish, this was an Issa Torah, because there were Menasech La Vaidazar. They took the wine, they poured it out in front of their idol, Lahavla, in front of the Getchka on the altar. So we don't have that anymore. We have what's called Stam Yenam, regular wine of Goyim, that they have touched in some way after that. Today, not a whole big issue with wine. If you're going to bring wine, it's usually, all caterers, the first rule of all catering is yayin mevushal. Can't get yayin she'ena mevushal into the hall. So that's not really that much of an issue in the workplace. Occasionally, if a colleague is invited to a simcha, again, that's already been taken care of. The caterers are not taking in yayin she'ena mevushal.
What would be a good way to explain when a not Jew,
yeah,
asks you, why do you have these rules with wine or milk, wine is the big.
Okay. The end of that whole brisa lists all 18 reasons. It says the gozru mishum yena mishum b'naisehem. Ultimately is because of their daughters. If you fraternize, that's the correct verb, and you get too familiar, eventually you're going to marry their daughters. So that's what we know. What are you going to tell them? We have a tradition, and you can always fall back on that. Our tradition is that we drink only certain wines, and that's what we do.
You know, nobody believes you. The kosher wine is terrible. So if you get them the kosher, it'll be perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
Oh, more bad.
That's right. And try to make it as sweet as... Yeah, first of all, you can't drink their wine. They can drink your wine. And you bring them a bushel, it's not a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
They think all kosher wine is manischewitz, it's just a bottle of sugar.
Yeah, fine. Yeah. There's no reason to disabuse anyone of that. All right, what you said about, by the way, a Michal Shabbos, a Yiddus, a Nashem Shabbos, there are 2 days brought in the Achroinim whether we are machmer on Stam Yenim, Lahal, Meikra Adin, we're not. There's a minig, though, to be machmer. And so when you have someone at the Shabbos table who's not yet observant, generally the minig is Yain Mevushal. Okay, it's not ma'akiv, but that's the minig.
So if you, by mistake, have
Namavoshal, yeah. I mean, unless the Chassidus are much more makbar on that. Much, much more, okay? You ask me, the yeshiva litvusha approach would be in the Ikra Din, we hold this permitted, yeah. There is a minig to be machmer, but that's, you know, certain is not required, la halacha. Yes?
If you have yain that's not Mavoshal,
yes.
And let's say there are yain at a Shabbos table, whatever the story is, factually speaking,
yeah.
Someone is not froze. What happens to that wine?
Well, if it was out of sight, remember, as long as you're there, or at least coming in and out, they're not going to be touching it. It's only when you're gone. This happens when you have a plumber in the house, non-Jewish plumber.
Right.
Okay, and he's working in the kitchen. You're in the basement. You know, a half hour later, suddenly you remember, oh, I had a bottle of wine there. And it was open. It's Einam Avushal. That's where we have to pour it out. I mean, that's... Unless he thinks you're going to come up every time, but if you told him I'm going to be downstairs for an hour, I'm going to don't bother me for an hour, so then he's not.
If there are literally people sitting there, they're not touching it. They're just
Then there's not a problem. It's only if they pour from it or touch the wine itself. Yeah, there's something else you can do. This goes back to the 1970s. My uncle was a rav in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, so he had wine, and in those days. You didn't have such a selection of wine. He would buy big gallon jugs of Yain She'en Mevushal, pour it into a pot and cook it up until it starts bubbling, and then so you can do that at home too. You don't have to be a rav of a shul to do that. Right? If you think, what am I going to do with this wine? What happens if people touch it? Pour it in a pot, put it on the stove or even the microwave, and let it get nice and bubbly, hot and steaming, and then that's it. It's Mevushal. Okay. Bishalakum. Okay, Bishalakum. I don't know if this comes out of the workplace as much as the home. The home, people have non-Jewish help, and sometimes they cook. A restaurant, yeah, 100%. A restaurant. Even if it's kosher food, all the ingredients are kosher. If a guy cooks it, the chamur geyser, on those items, there are two requirements for Bishalakum. Oops, I realize I'm attached over here. Okay, so let's do this. Test.
It's caught on the...
There are two requirements. I see what I did. Tyrus Nikna Bissur, you know? Okay. Tyrus. Okay, so... for Bishalakum, there are two requirements when it is Bishalakum. Number one, it's Einoi Nechal, Kemoi Shevuchai. It must be something you cannot eat in a raw state. So, an apple, even a cooked apple, if a guy cooks an apple, it's no Bishalakum. Why? Because you can eat an apple without being cooked. Or carrots, cooked carrots. Right? We eat raw carrots and salad all the time. But a potato is bishalakum, because you're not going to eat the potato uncooked. If you do, actually, it's shahakal, not even bar piadam. It's not royal achil in the normal way. So that's number one. Second of all, it is oyle al shulchan malachim. Meaning, it is something that is a high quality food that you would serve shulchan malachim. You give it at a chasen. So, for example, a quart of chicken, or even a quart of chicken, or any piece of chicken to them, even an eighth of a chicken, you chop it up into halves, would be oil al shulchan malachim, and that's something appropriate to serve. But the niblet corn, when you buy corn in a container, it's steamed. The whole question about what's the heter of Henkin Zichron Vracha had a tshuva that steaming it in the package is not bishalak. And one of the svaras he said, because each nibble of these niblets, these little pieces of corn, is not oil al shulchan malach. You don't serve one of them. Sir, corn of the cob, that's chashuv, you know, that's served in adult fare. But the niblets, which are pieces, it would not be oil shulchan malach. What about coffee? There's a big tumult in the Paiskin. How are you allowed to drink coffee that's cooked by Goyim, which we routinely do? You can go into a Starbucks, and first of all, let's just talk about Bishalakim. It's all non-Jewish employees. They cook the water. They take the coffee, and they put it in, and they mix it, and all the rest of that. So how are you allowed to buy coffee at Starbucks or any of the places around here, any place? So the answer is because the coffee itself is a powder. It's not oil al shulchan malach. Alternatively, because really it's water that's flavored. And it's flavored, there's a Taisus and Brachas that asks, why don't you make a bar minim mezonis on beer? Beer is fermented out of barley, it should be, and you cook the barley, it's a mash, and then it's fermented. So why is it a shahaka? Why not a mezonis? The Taisus says, because it's water, it's glorified water. So the same is true for coffee.
Sweet potatoes, or if you cook any type of pureed food for the child, because it's not whole on his day. Okay, whole on shulchan malachim.
Well, the sweet potato is. A sweet potato is oil shulchan malachim.
It's like a pureed,
You pureed after it's cooked, isn't it? No?
Right, the final product. Oh, it goes to the. Okay, so it's not like the final product.
Right, that's right. You're pureeing it after you cooked it. By then, it's ready bishalakim. All right. Now, there's another thing we need to know. How do all restaurants? I mean, you know, they all have hopefully documented workers, but a lot of them are not Jewish. So, what do? The answer is they control the fire. If the yid turns on the fire, it's no longer bishalakim. Or if he adds to the fire, the Ashkenazim or the Ramah is much more makel than the Sfaradim, than the Mechaber. According to the Mechaber, you have to actually start the fire and put the pot on there. According to the Ramah, as long as you started the fire and the guy did not turn it on or off, so the way it works in a restaurant, the control for the fire, the on-off switch is under the control of the Mashgiach only. It's either a lock or it's a code. My mother-in-law was a secretary in the OU Kashrus division at one time, and there was a bakery out in Des Moines, Iowa, that had the OU Hechsher. Every morning, she got to work about 8 o'clock in the morning, she would call, I think they're in the central time zone, so it was 7 o'clock there. She would call, punch in the codes, and that would start up the fires. So that was considered Ali Day Yisrael, because the only person on planet Earth who had this code was my mother-in-law. And she wouldn't have shown up, it wouldn't have started. However, she was very regular. She'd come all the time. Maybe her boss, her supervisor, had it as well. But the point being that if a yid starts the fire, then it's not bishalakim, it's bishal Yisrael.
Is the pilot cap?
Yes, if it's a pilot that we know only is under the control of the Jew. Yeah, that's generally what's done. You don't have to leave the whole thing burning, and you can have multiple fires come off the pilot light.
What's the issue with Rabbi Steinberg and the food trucks? Like someone told me, there's some issue with who starts it up, and that's why people don't eat on the.
I'm not familiar with the issue. No. Why they have hot food on the trucks? You mean?
Yeah, it's
the meat trucks are
right here.
There's a meat truck.
Like these stands that stand on the corner. Yeah, it's a whole truck.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a couple that are under Rabbi Avraham Steinberg. And people told me that there's some sort of.
Perhaps it might be. I don't know. It might be. It could be the products or the visual. I'm not sure.
Okay. These restaurants that obviously they're turning the flame up and down, on and off during the course of the day. So the pilot light remains.
Sometimes the pilot light remains on a whole week. Mashgiach turns it off Erev Shabbos. Okay, so it can stay on at night. Again, it has to be under the control of Mashgiach. The keys and the fires, first two things you have to check for in Hashgacha, which is usually not seen by the general public. I mean, we see the front of the store, but the back of the store is where the action is. where the cooking and the fires and all that, that has to be under the control of the mashgiach. Capacity to turn it on or off.
Yeah? So if a fire is left on,
yes,
the mashgiach would have to come back for the rest of the week technically.
Well, and not to turn on the fire. There may be many other reasons to come back.
You wouldn't need a mashiach there all the time.
If that's the only job that he has, no. But it's unlikely. So, but it could be that he leaves it on and stays on for the whole week. That's common.
The principle of Yisrael Omed Al Gavav doesn't alleviate the problem?
No. The Yisrael has to do an act that assists in the cooking. Turning on the fire, putting the pot on the stove.
So you turn on the fire in the morning, and the mashgiach is going in and out of the kitchen consistently. What do I care if the goy lowers the flame, turns on the flame, turns it off, then turns it on? If Yisrael Omed Al Gavav is a principle that gives us some degree of certainty that nothing untoward is going to be happening,
mm-hmm.
it's as if it doesn't really matter what he's doing.
Okay. All right. The answer is because here the act of bishul akum renders the food unkosher. You can't eat it if a guy cooked it. It's not a question that we're afraid that he may, for example, switch something that's treif into the food chain. We're saying that he's going to do the act that the chacham don't want him doing. We don't want a non-Jew cooking on behalf of a Jew because that again leads to closeness. So the yid, the Jew, has to actually do part of the cooking. Some action that he does, which would involve turning on the flame, putting the food in the pot, or putting the pot on the fire.
Is there a way to accept that it's like industrially produced by the non-Jewish baker, is it somewhat okay, or something like that? Is there some exception that even a non-Jewish baker can
bake? Baking. We're talking about baking and cooking. Bishul akum is cooking, which means with water. Baking is in an oven. Pas akum is bread or bread products such as pretzels, right? Cookies, crackers, anything you basically, most of what you make in the Zionist on. If a guy produced it, even with all kosher ingredients, it's pas akum. Now, according to the Bavli, there is no heter. This is pretty amazing. The Rosh in the Sefer Avodah Zarah says that we in Ashkenaz, the Soimich on the Yushalmi, which is mekel mishum chayei nefesh, because it's a life of man. How can you know? Although loyal lechem levada yichye ha'adam, but you eat bread to live. Without bread, it would be very tough. So therefore, the Yushalmi says that we're mekel on pas akum, where it's a commercial baker, where it's pas palter. Palter means it's commercial. There's less likelihood that he'll put in tarfus or things like that.
Is donut considered bishul akum or pas akum? So is Dunkin' Donuts under the head there pas palter or?
Dunkin' Donuts, you have to worry about the ingredients. You don't know if unless it's packaged. It becomes packaged with a heksher.
Would that be pas palter as in baking or that?
There are many things that are cooked and then baked. Every bagel, they first boil it in water. That gives it the texture and the chewiness, and then they bake it. But it has been a pas. So a donut as well is first dunked in water. And then it's baked. So the dough itself, not the filling. So the, that has been of pas. Pas palter, today we need a heksher on all these things because we don't know about the ingredients. It's not so simple. There are so many additives and lubricants and all the rest of that go in that you basically need a heksher on everything you eat today except for like raw vegetables and fruits. It's hard to say we're going to be soymich on pas akum. Yeah.
So at what point does the status quo shift from needing a heksher? Because obviously, as you talked about earlier, when hekshers were non-existent, obviously then you didn't need a heksher or anything. So what was the halacha breaking point from which is advisable or is you need it? I think nowadays it's oftentimes considered you're so guilty anything that doesn't have it, even if you can grill the person on what's exactly in the food. So
okay. What was that point? Alright, the shift came about because of the revolution of food technology, which is that besides chemistry, packaging, the whole food industry made great leap forward starting about 25 years ago, the 1990s, when distribution became more available and advertising, the whole industry took a leap forward, and a lot of regulations in terms of preservatives, labeling requirements, so that now it's so complex that you really need a hasher. You know, you could not begin to understand what's in every food. Even a lot of the food people themselves, you know, have specialties. This one knows about additives. This one knows about the enzymes that are used, some of which are derived from animals. You know, even when you call up the OU, they're not uniformly experts. So certainly for us, that a layman in this, we can't begin to hope to understand it. So you need a hechsher. Fortunately, like I said, half the food products in America have a hechsher.
Yeah, but there's a lot of different ones. Like, for example, there's a Dunkin' Donuts in Lexington and 53rd that's under what, like, R. Mellon of the National Food Network or something like that.
Okay.
What he calls himself. And he has a number of Dunkin' Donuts under his stuff now. But can he rely on pop culture? Is that how he's able to at least certify the donuts?
I mean, I would presume he does, or I can't speak on his behalf, you know, so. But when it comes to Hashem, you have to know who's, you know, you have to speak to the person himself, yeah.
But in the class of Bishalach,
yes.
Well, let's say you have an elderly person with an aid.
Right.
And he's not Jewish. So, if the elderly person is simply directing the person what to do, is that good enough?
The yid has to do an action, either, again, turning on the fire. Then what you should do is put in these boxes you can get, which are remotely controlled. In other words, it fits over the stove, and or yeah, usually over the stove, and or a microwave, and then a relative comes in and turns it on and leaves it on, and then all day long the aide can cook in it.
The starter.
Starter, it'll start up. Yeah, the oven will be on at some level. Yeah, so they can't be turned off.
There's no head down saying.
Yeah.
Just by directing somebody.
No, directing is not enough. It has to be an action. Now again, Rabbi said Bishalakim is really more of an issue in a home setting than the office. I don't remember it coming up too often, except like you said, you know, this cooking class. But and
because it's the thing now, when you're a summer associate, they have activities. They want the experiences with
Warming food, not a problem. Okay, warming, very good. Let's talk about warming. Bishul is only on raw foods, a pre-cooked item, such as a hot dog. A hot dog is edible right out of the package, believe it or not. Okay, doesn't taste too good, Cole. A lot of things like knishes, a lot of things like that. When you heat it up, or someone heats it up on your behalf, they're not doing the act of bishul that was pre-cooked. And therefore it's not bishalakim. Bishal has to be that it was original cooking. It wasn't edible, it was ein enach l'chai, this was edible the way it was.
Abigail delivers their meals from like BC-based things,
yeah.
And they'll ship in a full set of utensils and a full meal.
And these things are the other side.
Sure.
Bring it out with the rest of the non-kosher food. Yours is just wrapped.
Okay, which brings us to the next topic. I'm happy you brought it up. Ordering in, the communal refrigerator and ordering in, which is food from the outside brought to your office, and the halachas of basar shenis ale min ha'ayin, which literally means meat that was hidden from the eye. Okay, it's a big sugya in chulin, whether we prohibit it, which we do finally, and the Gemara says like this in Masechta Vaidazar, Amar Rav, chavis asur. Let's put that as an acronym. Chavis aser b'chaisam echad and champag. Let's write this down. Chavis. This is where we talk about how you can get a non-Jew to deliver food to you from another Jew, and to know that the chain of custody is not broken. Okay, we have to know that it was in the same status, kasher status, when it left Reuven as when it came to Shimon. Along the way, there was a black box. What happened there? So we have a concept known as a chaisam, a seal, which serves to authenticate. Very big issue in today's world, and you know, data authentication. And this really is a kind of metadata associated with the food. You want to know. I know what the food is, piece of chicken. But is it kosher chicken or non-kosher? I can't tell by looking at it. If I can, it has a plumba, which is a simen, terrific. It doesn't have a simen, so I need to have a way of authenticating, which we say is a double seal. Now, what is chavis?
Oops.
Chatichas dag, okay, so fish falls under this rubric. Basar, meat. Yayin, wine. And Tchelas, which you wouldn't think of. Tchelas,
which is used for making tzitzis, which of course we don't have today, but that falls under the requirement of two seals. You need one seal or a knot and another one on top of it. Why? Because if the non-Jew would attempt to undo it, you could tell. You could tell that it's torn or broken or misplaced, so that would be a way of authenticating that it was original. There are four other ones, by contrast.
It has to be double sealed.
Yeah, these require a double seal.
Okay. What about salmon, though? I know a lot of people eat the salmon from Costco because it's an identifiable fish.
Okay. So salmon, again, chatichas dag is non-identifiable. One piece of fish pretty much looks like the others. Now, what happens if it has scales on it? You have, it's raw and it still has part of the skin on it, and you see there are scales. So can you eat that? What do you need to identify a kosher fish? Fins and scales. It doesn't have fins. If I have a whole tuna fish, you know, let's say I buy a pound of raw tuna. Okay, so if I have a whole tuna fish, I got the scales, but a tuna fish weighs 200 pounds. So.
All the scales.
What's that?
All the scales. Any fish that has scales.
Oh, so the Chazal tell us, this is a famous Mishnah in Sefer Chulin, Kol sheyesh lo kaskeses, yesh lo snapir. Chazal are made that there is no fish in this world that has scales without fins. Of all the thousands of species, if it's a scaly fish, that's what they call it. Scale fish are all fins. They're all fin fish. Now, this is a remarkable statement of Chazal. First of all, they weren't required to say it, because the Torah says, Snapir v'kaskeses. So why not just tell every yid, go ahead, when you go fishing, find scales and fins, and don't ask me a question. Yeah, you need scales and fins. But they went out on a limb. This one's Sefer HaKuzri. They went on a limb to say, Kol sheyesh loy kaskeses, if it has scales, has fins. This is the Gemara says in Chulin, it's a Raya l'tarim min ha-shamayim. Yad l'tar v'yadir. That's why. If the Gemara asks, if scales are enough, what if they fins? Yad l'tar v'yadir. Which means, says the Kuzri, it's a Raya, a direct proof that l'tarim min ha-shamayim, has never been contradicted in all the thousands of years. And moreover, why even say such a thing? Unless you're confident, because you have a Messiah from Sinai that doesn't exist.
That's your discovery of
me. Yeah, this is. I remember years back reading there was an expedition up the Orinoco River, which is a tributary of the Amazon out in Brazil, and they came back with 300 species of fish they had never seen before. 300. Which is reminiscent of the Gemara in Be'er, or Gamliel says, with 300 types of dogim in Aku, and he cooked them and so on, 300 types of species, very interesting. And I saw pictures, I had pictures up on the web of them. You couldn't find any one of them that had scales without fins. The ones that had, I mean, they were like eels and stuff like that, that don't have scales or fins, but the ones that had scales or fins, just remarkable. Chazal said this. In any event, fish needs either scales or another simon. Some people are semich on the orange flavor of salmon to say that it indeed is kosher.
It's the only orange fish there is.
Do you know any others? I don't know.
It's pink fish.
What?
You'll see Costco people.
Okay.
Does the Costco have the one you wanted anyway?
Yeah, not on the frozen fish. Well, on the frozen.
So, okay. So these all need a double seal. Then the other four are chiltis, which is kind of vegetable, marais, which is fish brine, pas and gvina.
Let's put down the last two. Pas and gvina, or bread and cheese, only need one seal. So these need two, and this needs even a single seal. Why? But what would you theorize? There are two reasons. Well, what we can come up. What's the common denominator between these three and, by contrast, these two?
More prestigious, more expensive.
Which ones?
Well,
One's on top. And therefore,
more likely to be,
oh, more likely to be falsified, right?
About the Muncie cheesemakers.
Right. Okay. Wine, there's a big yetzahara to take cheap wine and pass it off as fancy wine. Meat, fish. Fish is even more expensive than meat. A lot of cuts of fish are sky high. So this is where Tosfos and the Torah and most of Rishonim learn. Rashi learns. That's what Rashi learns. I'm sorry. Rashi learns because of the cost. This is relatively cheap. Bread, cheese, simpler. So we're not as choshesh. The guy has less of an incentive. If there's less of an incentive, so all you need is one seal or one sign. Tosfos and the Rambam and the Torah, and this is where we hold the halacha, say, these are the raisa, so this is drabanim. Pasakum, zigzeres chacham. Gvina sakum, cheese of goyim, is also only awesome with drabanim. But Dad, tray fish, minatayra, right? Crab and all the rest of that. Meat, obviously minatayra. Wine, although stam yenam is drabanam, but they were geyser as if it was shaltayra, because it derived from vadazar. Okay, so we need two seals. What constitutes a seal? What does that mean? So, in the old days, it was a knot. You know, they took a bag, they had like a wine skin, you knotted it. And then you took another skin, you knotted it over, and you could tell by the knot who had done it. There's a, you know, the sailors know, each one has their signature knots that they do, so that you can have. So there's one way of telling. Another very common one today are letters. The olive bays serve as a seal. It can also be English letters. So if it says on the package, under the hashgacha of the OU, you know, the hisachtos, whichever one, and it's wrapped around, like in the airline meals. The tape. Because if it would be torn, it's recognizable. You would see that something's different, and therefore the chain of custody has been broken, and this is what we rely on. So when you're ordering in for a meal, you must see, because it's usually delivered by non-Jewish delivery, you have to see that there is some unbroken seal that has usually letters in two places, writing, text, and this way you know that if it's just in an open bag, a sandwich, let's say, you know, pastrami on rye, and it comes in an open sandwich, can't eat that. Yes.
People typically unwrap it. It's actually very difficult to tear.
Yeah.
The whole basis is on the tearability of the letters. Wouldn't the tape that's commonly used for delivery not serve that purpose?
If indeed you can take it off and put it back without noticing it. The question is, could he undo it, change it, and put it back?
All the tape in New York City, you can do it and put it back, and it's nearly impossible to actually tear across the letters because of the plastic material. Every single restaurant that delivers from every kosher restaurant is seamless.
Seamless meaning that you could tell if it was tampered with?
Any of the most well-known kosher restaurants,
it's tamper-proof.
A very plastic tape that you easily take off, put back, and that's actually very difficult to rip by letters.
So when you take it off, is it evident that it was taken off, or you wouldn't be able to?
I could take it off and take it right back. It's like a piece of plasticky, not even duct tape, you know, like plasticky.
Yeah.
Tape, so it just doesn't seem at all meat.
That's strange, very strange. And
the
inside is not taped at all?
No, so like, you know, a meat place where you've both got tape and a staple, so open line will do that. And then like a dairy place or somewhere else, they'll just use the tape. And then the wrap around again.
Yeah, well, dairy, all you need is one seal.
Right,
so that
dairy, but meat places too, you know.
They have a problem also with seamless. They ran a news story a week or two ago, I think, Mike's Bistro, where basically you can order on seamless, and they are basically what are called ghost restaurants.
Uh-huh.
So you'll order a meal which you think is coming from, let's say, Mike's Bistro, but you're actually getting some guy in your home churning it out. And then
that's the problem. That's why you need
Mike's Bistro that was getting
I'm not sure. You'd have to speak to the restaurant or the mashgiach and ask him about it.
It's citywide.
Really? Okay.
If supermarket delivery, isn't it the same issue?
If what?
Supermarket delivery.
Same idea.
You're ordering fish that has one siman and there's not a Jewish person that's delivering it.
That's
an exception.
Yeah.
They should need a double seal.
You generally do need a double seal, yeah. Yeah. All I know is when I get stuff, it's always double wrapped, and I have a tough time even just, you know, opening the thing. It's a. Usually they are double wrapped. If you think that it's not sealed according to the, you know, way I'm saying it here, maybe you should ask the mashgiach there or call up the certifying agency and ask them what their policy is. Yeah.
The office microwave. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We can try to wrap up here. The office microwave is something. This is pretty much in all offices. You know, you can smell all the stuff cooking there. Now, again, you need to double seal. You're probably not going to kosher the microwave. I don't want to get into koshering it because it's unlikely. What you can do is double seal what you're doing by putting it in one plastic bag, tying it, and then putting it in another one, and putting something underneath like a paper plate. This effectively insulates it from all the tarifus that has collected there. And there's no interchange of hot air or steam between your food and what's in there. Now, if everything sort of explodes open, which happens sometimes, if you left it in too long, then you can't use the stuff, okay? There's been an interchange. If the hot steam hits the top of the microwave and there's some drippings there and it gets into you, that's mavliya into your food. But if it's at a reasonable temperature, the bag sort of expands, but you see that it's intact, then the heat has simply penetrated. It's really just microwave radiation that moves the molecules and heats it up inside your bag. There's no interchange with the outside.
Is that the same with your microwave at home, using it for milk and flavor?
Exactly the same, yes.
You'd have to double seal it.
Double seal. And what we do is we take one plastic bag, tie a knot, second one, tie a knot in that, and then put a paper plate on.
Really sealed,
yeah, there can't be any venting of steam. Yeah. What's that? Ziploc sometimes sort of busts open. Yeah.
That's the problem. If a problem is Ziploc's busting open,
yeah,
then using the regular bags, tightening it, but if they're not busting open, then they're leaking.
They're expanding, but what?
Yeah, I'm not talking about expanding, but again,
yeah,
there's stuff going in.
Yeah. The Ziploc can't expand, so it basically has a fault line along the lock.
If you take the air out,
yeah,
it will expand.
But it won't break the seal?
It's a function of how long.
I guess. If it does, then it does. If it does, then again.
You know, so you're basically not trusting the microwave, in other words. So if you're double bagging it, you're basically, you can do a double bagging with a non-kosher microwave, too.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That's what you can do.
There is no such thing, in other words, as a kosher microwave in a public place. No. I have to be at Holy Rooms, and there's non-Jewish staff coming in and out to get food. And
I would double bag it there, for sure. Even in the bigger Holy Room, yeah. In a hotel, maybe, because they do clean it very meticulously. All the ones that I've gone to, I mean, these things are clean, perhaps. And you also have to know, is it within 24 hours, you know. There, perhaps. In an office, though, no. You see that they're dirty.
The 24 hours would apply there, even if...
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about Blia. Yes, ma'am. What, you're talking about running a cycle?
Yeah. But so for a microwave, why can't you...
Well, a microwave, you have to stand there and scrub. At home, you will clean your oven. If there's drippings, it's not going to help. You got to clean it, or it's self-clean, it'll do it. You're not going to stand there, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the office with a scrub.
At home,
yeah. If it's a self-clean, man, it's got to be clean. The microwave also has to be clean. But at home, I'm willing to stand there and clean it. It's my own use, my family.
But do you have to double that at home?
You would have to then kosher it using... Remy Feinstein says you take a cup of water, you let it boil up until the whole water boils out, usually about, I don't know, 12, 15 minutes, and that serves to kosher the microwave once it's totally clean.
Okay. So I can have a meat oven and just like double wrap a tinfoil piece of pizza and heat up my pizza in the oven?
Tinfoil? Well, plastic, again. You know, tinfoil couldn't do it in a microwave. Yeah, and again, make sure pizza, remember, is also very oily, so you want to make sure on the bottom it's not going to ooze out, right? It can be done. Yeah. It could be done. Okay, generally we try not to. We keep our microwave milchik. It's just too complex to make a fleishik and then worry that it's going to, you know, leak out and stuff. So.
You can kosher your microwave by just cleaning it in a cup of water.
And all the water boils out, and that's tantamount. Yeah, that's where Moshe holds. Yeah, we're pretty makel with that. You don't have to be malab in it or anything like a regular oven because it's not convecting heat in the same way. But in the office, wrapping it a number of times and putting some plates under it, you know, paper plates. Entertaining clients, I write down, is maintaining Kedusha. The food is always the easiest part. You know, there's so many places to have clients, fancy restaurants. You mentioned Abigail's, and there's a whole string of them around here. The idea really is to keep the level of the conversation, what's transacted, at the level of, you know, kedoshim to you. Because all of what the Chachamim said about food is really an offshoot of that deraisa. It might be a drabana, but the fact that we act in a refined way and our speech is different and our thoughts are elevated and the way we conduct ourselves is different, that's really has its source in a deraisa of kedoshim to you, like the Ramban says. And when we're with a client, it's just like we would be at a Shabbos table. I'm the same yid, surrounded by my family singing Zmiras, or with a client doing a business deal. And the notion is that the food is only one aspect. It's really the setting. That's really what I want to bring out. Yes?
And similar, when it comes to the halakha concept of Moshe Abelitzi, are there delineations? I'm just honest enough, does that apply to certain people, certain conversation matter? I always heard it was kind of like a nebulous thing, but are there clear parameters? What is a Moshe Abelitzi?
Yeah, yeah. It's clearly contextual. Okay, so to go to a comedy club with clients, I don't know. I mean, today's comedy is probably Moshe Leitzin. You know, it's hostile, it's vulgar in many respects. It's, you know, I don't know that, you know, I think it would probably trip over that. There are certain people, I remember at work, you know, you couldn't sit near them. There were a couple of Yiddelach, you know. They had all the old Yiddish jokes and all the language that went along with it, and I could not be in their Dalaramas. I'm sorry to say, when I tell you, these guys. I would imagine that there is. I don't know that that's so true with clients, because there's a certain business-like sense that you bring when you have a client. It's usually with your colleagues, with the gang, after you've finished the deal. Now they're letting loose.
The journalists too. There's a lot of time value in networking and retaining familiar relationships. So, you know, it's always like a scale. Usually, you know, people
correct.
Have levels of relevance for.
They should know, what's your first name?
Aaron.
They should know, you know, when Aaron's in the room, there's certain jokes they just don't say. You know, it happens to be true. They said, you know, because you, the way you conduct yourself, broadcast to the world, you know, I'm part of you and I contribute and I put in my time and I'm collegial and I share. And there's certain limits in the arena of jokes and that, where there's limits, and they'll get it from your behavior, from your essence.
Would you define it as more in the realm of vulgarity, either as subject matter or language, more in the realm of, you know, joking, non-seriousness? Obviously, there's a cross.
Yeah, yeah. Joking, a little bit of irreverence, I think that's fine. That gives them a sense of ease, and you can work together when everything's not so formal. Okay, however, vulgarity and you know, there's, you know, that can't, it's so antithetical to what we are. We're from people, you know, we have families, we have a Kaddish Baruch, we have a Tarak Dosh, and to engage in the low level talk that basically is normal in society, you know, I'm not blaming anyone, that's what they hear and they see. They get a sense, and I've seen this in my own business life. I saw, and I walked into the room, certain topics were muted. Yeah.
So, because you mentioned the food in Kedusha, so
yeah.
Abigail's is a good restaurant, but there are plenty of clients that don't want to go to Abigail's.
Okay.
They want to go to high-end steakhouses like BTK or the others.
So BTK is what?
Very expensive steakhouse.
It's kosher?
No,
non-kosher. Okay.
So what happens is you order in from Abigail's to BTK,
uh-huh.
And Abigail sends the meal to BTK. BTK then puts it in their oven and heats it, and then it comes out. So everyone has their fine non-kosher food, and you have your
kosher
meal.
Yeah.
You know, I work at Kippa when I do that. So, but it's like it's a guy with Kippa sitting in a non-kosher restaurant eating his kosher food.
Not more sign.
That's what I'm curious. Is that an issue? There are good kosher restaurants. There's still a lot of people that want to go to a non-kosher restaurant.
Right. All right. There is an opinion that says even walking into a non-kosher restaurant is more sign. However, you could be samech on the idea that, for example, to go in to use a restroom would be permitted because you're not eating there. Not that everyone knows it, though, but if it's obvious that you went in to use a restroom, So that would be...
No, you're sitting at the table.
You're sitting at the table.
Exactly the same. So Abigail's is not sitting in plastic China.
Do they have a regular plate? Is there any indication that it's different than everyone else?
Yeah, keep, if they saw the package come out, they saw the tape.
Maybe keep the tape in the package.
Exactly.
I remember before... I remember when I was, before I worked for the Times, I worked for CompuServe, and they were still around. And their headquarters is in Columbus. They sent us out for training. We went to their headquarters in a country club. And the same thing, they brought me out the meal, and the waiter, to be helpful, had taken it out of the packaging. So, of course, I couldn't eat anything. I sat there with a glass of water and a toothpick. And I was... There is a discomfort, and strictly speaking, I think it's evident if you keep the stuff on the table. You know, there's a Ramon Hilchas Purim, which will be relevant soon, which is, he says that there was a minig, it's actually in Yeraday, Hilchas Basar B'chol, there was a minig on Purim to eat duck cooked in almond milk. You know? So it's Marasayan, there's milk, right? It looks like chicken and milk, or duck and milk. So he says you should take almonds and put it all around the base of the chicken or this duck, so people see when they cut the duck it's almond milk. I would say, just to answer your question, keep some of the wrapping on the table.
It would help the people nearby. It really would help the people walking by the window.
Yeah, yeah.
What's
that? In the days of the Ramon Krakow, 450 years ago, you know, apparently that was a delicacy. They had duck cooked in almond milk.
We also have now the non-requirement to have your coffee-rich container on the table at the fairs. So many years ago, when the Moshe said you should have, if you're having a bar of dairy cream, a bar of creamers, you should leave it in the container.
In the container, right.
No caterer today.
Correct. All right, I'll tell you why.
So
excellent.
Is there a presumption that there's enough knowledge and information out there to offset the Marisai concern?
Yeah, it's not only enough knowledge and information, but actually the practice has been so widespread now that you have parva milk that everyone knows, which is amounts to the same. But in a trefa restaurant, it's not true. You would need a hecker. Yeah, you're going to need something there. If there is a heter entirely, I mean, if you want to be makel to walk in there. No, it's on you. It's a,
You're sitting in a high estate, have the cap on.
Have it on the table, should we have it? All right, everybody, so I want to finish up with one more thing. Okay, I want to end up with really one more thing regarding brachas. This is something that comes up and people may not think of it. Okay, here's a typical scenario. You're eating at your desk and you go to wash. You have a sandwich. You ordered in or you brought from home. Doesn't matter. You go to wash. Men's room is down the hall, whatever. You wash your hands, made the bracha, you come back. On the way back, somebody asks you, oh, it's good you're here. Did you get the report from last week? What? Did you get the report from that? Okay. I learned early on never to make a bracha until I was back in my chair. Okay? Wash my hands, and I walk. My hands are wet. Now, you can't make a bracha if your hands are dry. Because on Atilas Yadayim, they all ask, how do you make the bracha after you wash? You're supposed to make a bracha, Ayur Velasi Yosem, before you do the mitzvah. So washing is a mitzvah. The answer is drying is a part of the mitzvah. Therefore, you make the bracha when your hands are wet before you dry them. Okay? But you can't dry them in the bathroom and walk back with dry hands. Your hands are wet. But no one seems to notice. You know, walk like this. You know,
walk to my room too.
Hello. Yes. Tomorrow. Yo, how are you meeting? Oh, very nice. Get back. I'm trying to say something. Do the whole thing.
Are you suggesting that if you spoke, it's a problem?
No. You didn't make the bracha yet.
I don't say no. In the case where you made a bracha already,
would it be a problem?
The truth is,
you probably have to.
Like the normal, and then if somebody interrupts you before you make your choice,
yeah. You know, it's an amazing thing. We are trained since children not to talk then, and the Mechaber just says it's a minik toiv not to. It's a good minik. It's not a requirement. And yet in this case, you'd probably have to, right? And to avoid all that, wash, keep your hand, don't dry, you know, have a paper towel back at your desk or whatever you have, and dry your hands in your at your desk, till you die, you know, hamaitzi. That's number one. So that a second question is shinui makim. Typically, nashina makim tzarach levarach. When I make a bracha, I made a shahakal here on this. If I go into the next room, I have to make another bracha. It's a different place, unless I had it in mind. So often, you're at your desk, you have a coffee, let's say, and then it's, oh, by the way, we're meeting down the hall. It's always best when you make the bracha at your desk to think to yourself, wherever in this building I need to be, I have in mind the whole building. It helps for the whole building.
If you leave that building, though, does the kavana not help?
It does not help. It has to be in the building.
What if you deliberately sip on something as you step out the door?
You need the bracha as you step out.
Yeah, so that must be sishah kol, and then keeping that rule in mind, as you walk out of the door, you take a drink. Part of you in, part of you out.
Every 4 amos you need another bracha outside. No. Keeping in mind, Hesed Hadas occurs at the door of the building. Yeah. The whole building, yes. The auditorium, the meeting room, yeah.
As you walk out.
Yeah.
Drinking outside.
Is that okay to go inside? No, no. You wait until you get inside. Same thing when you're running out into the car in the morning. Let's see, your carpool's waiting. Make the bracha in the car, not at home. Okay, it won't help for the car. It's a shinui makom.
So, even
it's in your hand, yeah.
Bread,
yes. Ah, now, not a good etza. Let's say I washed, and now this afternoon I have a meeting, and I'm going out to my other location. As long as you made the bracha and pasta and had in mind, you can eat bread in the other place, but you can't just drink there. You have to have actually bread in the other place as well. All right, the more common scenario is, you're just in your office doing work and you're drinking your coffee and somebody calls you out to another room and you didn't have it in mind. So, as a general way, always think, at work, I'm making a bracha, I have in mind this whole building. Because, you know, 1 out of 10 or out of 5, someone's going to call me before the end of the coffee out of the room. Just an idea. There's something called another concept, Hesed Hadas. We tend to eat today in a pattern known as grazing. Grazing means you eat in the morning, you eat another half hour, and 20 minutes later you have a drink, and then you have a cookie, and then you have one of these energy bars. And the whole day, every 30 minutes or so, you're grazing, you're eating.
There's a kosher restaurant called
Graze now. Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, perfect. You know.
Steakhouse.
I remember once reading about the ratio, the graph line, the trend line of the number of cup holders in cars. When we were kids, didn't exist. Cup holder, ever heard of such a thing? Then they got one for the driver. Then they got one for the passenger seat. Then they got for the back seat. Now, there's 15 of them. My grandkids' baby seats have a cup holder now. I mean, it's, you know, the car seat. What? For the bottle. So, we graze. We're constantly eating. When are you masir das? How long does a bracha help when you made that first, let's say, shahakol on your coffee in the morning, and now it's 12:30 in the afternoon, okay, you're not quite going to lunch, but you've been grazing all morning, how long does it last? So, the idea has to be, you're not masir das. You didn't take your mind off. If you've been in your office the entire time, and you've been sipping the coffee, and you had a little of this, a little of that, you're probably within the thing, every half hour. If an hour and a half went by, and particularly if you were out of the room, you come back, you probably need another bracha when you have to take that soda out now that you're going to drink. So, again, at home, we have more defined eating episodes. You're in the kitchen. You eat. At work, it's sort of continuous. We have to keep in mind eating. And as Hesed Hadas. And finally, Birkas Hamazon, this is also common. You ate your sandwich, and then you didn't realize at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you look up, you forgot to bench, or you were sort of munching and you didn't finish eating. Essentially, it's Achi Yisakel Hamozain. When the food gets digested, you can no longer bench. Because you're Chalta of a Savata over after. You eat and you feel satisfied, then you bench. But I'm not satisfied, I'm hungry again. Where is the threshold? The threshold in a regular meal is 72 minutes, the place can say. If you wait 72 minutes, it's a suffix whether you can bench. Unless you had a very big meal,
not really likely in the office. You know, a Shabbos chalent, you know, big meal, so more than 72 minutes, you're not hungry. But in the office, maybe not. So, again, it's an awareness. What the awareness is, maybe set a timer. From the time I begin eating until this timer goes off, maybe an hour I should allow myself, 45 minutes. Make sure I bench, so I shouldn't have a suffix later on.
So, 72 minutes from the start of eating?
From the end, from the cessation of eating, yeah.
So eating bread or eating anything?
Anything. Yeah, the water, anything else. They told me I have to mention the following formula: legal ramifications of maintaining a separate kosher cafeteria. I spoke with a lawyer about this. As long as the establishment has a common policy for all, that all everyone's allowed to eat there, including non-Jews, it shouldn't be an issue. Even if they prohibit any food from coming in, which is common, kosher cafeteria not allowed to bring food, just like you can't bring food into Madison Square Garden, right, at any venue. Unless you buy from them. So the same way with a kosher cafeteria, that would be a legal distinction. Yeah.
Question about going to bars, right? Beer, as long as it's like a name brand beer, as long as there's no lime or lemon on it, right, then it's okay?
Okay, Sheikh Harakum, very glad you brought it up, because I wrote down about it. The Chachamim prohibited Yayin Shel Akum, that's in the Braisa. The Gemara and the Bavli adds Sheikhar. It says... Shechar's beer. Rav Papa used to buy beer in the store and drink it outside the store, and Rav Acha would bring it home. So Taisa says, because the beer in Eretz Yisrael, the drink was wine. In Babel, they had date palms. They used to ferment dates and make beer out of dates. So date beer, you're not allowed to drink where it's sold, namely in the bar. The Shach said, but barley you can. The Shach says we're machmer on barley beer as well. What does that mean? It's only beer on tap being drunk in the bar. So if there's beer on tap, you can't buy it and drink it there. You can take it home, but who takes home beer on tap? So, but they do sell bottles.
You can't drink alcoholic beer. Out of beer.
What's that?
Out of a bar, you can't take beer.
You can't there, right. So if you are in a bar, let's say, I don't know, clients or the gang from work is getting together afterwards, so you can buy a bottle, because that's not called bimakim.
But not the wine.
Yeah, lime and lemon is a halachic concern. It's a kashrus concern. This is a gzeira. The gzeira of beer would be, what's that?
What's the wine?
They put it
in the butt.
There's also the sharp or something, right? It's a sharp
fruit. The knife.
Yeah, the knife that cuts it is treif, so it renders a treif. I wouldn't allow them to put anything in the beer. I mean, beer is just fermented barley and hops, and it's, you know, water. That's it.
The bottle's okay, but you can't.
You cannot get draft on tap. Yeah, that's... What's that?
Doesn't the Ramah put a nickel opinion and the Mordechai's also nickel on it?
Yes, yeah, the Shach is machmeh, though, and the Achronim say we should be machmeh like that. Listen, so beer on tap in a bar, we won't drink. We can just, you know, there's 20 other selections they have. They have bottles.
Can you drink in a bar altogether? That's another question altogether.
Well, if it's a bar...
You have other issues about drinking in a bar with the goyim sitting there.
Well, that's exactly Sheikh or Shal Goyim, right? For that reason.
That it may not even help you.
There are certain bars obviously you're not going to want to walk into, all right? They're inappropriate. There are certain that are pretty upscale and are designed for business meetings.
To your
seat, then it would be permitted. You're drinking it outside of the chanus. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's. I guess so you can get some draft beer. So sometimes they bring a keg into the. At least in my days, they buy a keg like for an office party. They bring it right into the office. They do that still?
No.
No. Things may have changed.
Okay.
Maybe the morays are different now.
They have a whole problem because there's a keg. So it's an issue with too much each individual.
Okay. Right. A keg may be an issue, but
I haven't seen a keg in a little business.
Okay, so...